Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with remarks by Republican presidential candidate Mike Huckabee, who invoked the Holocaust in criticizing President Obama's deal with Iran, saying that Obama will take Israelis and march them to the doors of the ovens. Matthew Sutton, a professor of history at Washington State University and author of American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism, joins us to discuss Huckabee's attempt to appeal to Christian Zionists who love Israel because it is central to bringing about the rapture and the end of times, according to their interpretation of the Bible's book of Revelation. We will examine the relationship between American evangelicalism, apocalyptic thought, and political activism during times of national crisis and war. Then we'll look into the possible release of Jonathan Pollard, who is coming up for parole after serving 30 years for spying for Israel. CIA veteran Melvin Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and the author of National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, joins us to discuss the damage that Pollard did to America's national security and why this spy, who first tried to sell America's most valuable secrets to Libya, then Saudi Arabia, has become a hero in Israel and a bargaining chip in U.S.-Israeli relations. Then finally, we'll examine the talks underway in Ethiopia with President Obama and leaders from Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, Sudan, and the African Union over the future of South Sudan, which is mired in a brutal fratricidal war between two warring tribal factions. Lako Tongan, a professor of international and intercultural studies and political studies at Fraser College, who was born and raised in South Sudan, joins us to discuss what pressure can be brought to bear on South Sudan's president and vice president, whose personal war with each other has cost the world's newest country tens of thousands of its citizens killed, with 2.2 million displaced. And joining us now is Matthew Sutton, who's a professor of history at Washington State University and a research fellow at the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation. His first book, Amy Semple McPherson and the Resurrection of Christian America, won the Thomas J. Wilson Memorial Prize from Harvard University Press. And his latest book just out is American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Sutton.
Thanks, Ian, for having me on.
And it seems as though your latest book is absolutely right in tune with the latest political scandal or mini scandal or whatever it is with the candidate of a preacher himself and a TV personality and a former governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee, made this extraordinary statement that President Obama's P5 plus one deal with Iran, that Obama has the Israelis marching to the doors of the gas ovens. And it's been widely repudiated, particularly by Democrats, but some Republicans like Jeb Bush have also objected to it. But Rick Santorum supports it all the way. So what do you make of this? Is this about a bunch of nobodies in a crowded field trying to get attention?
No, I don't think so with Huckabee. I think he's somebody who has always been honest about his ideas and his beliefs. And this is extremely consistent with what evangelicals have seen as the importance of Israel for really the last 100 years. And so for him, he believes that part of why the U.S. has been so successful over the last, you know, really since the creation of the State of Israel, is because the U.S. was quick to recognize Israel as a state and to give it its support. And so anytime we waver from that, they're afraid that, you know, hell and damnation is coming upon us, that God rewards us for supporting the Jews and God's going to punish us if we don't.
Yeah, but the Christian Zionists, they want Armageddon, and Israel is merely a pawn in achieving Armageddon.
Yeah, that's the irony, and they know it, and the Israelis know it, but it doesn't stop either of them from using the other to benefit themselves, their own political agendas. And so they do believe that ultimately God is going to destroy Israel, that that's going to be the site of the Battle of Armageddon, this great end times cataclysm. But until then, they believe that God still has is still going to work through the Jews, work through the State of Israel, and that by supporting the State of Israel, God will then reward those nations like the U.S.
Well, but you'd think if they want Armageddon to happen, and, you know, that by their peculiar logic, that the Iranians getting a bomb would precipitate it.
Yeah, and that's the nice thing about this theology is they've always had to answer that criticism, and so they've always explained it, which is that, you know, when Jesus was on earth, he said he was going to return soon, but he said that Christians needed to occupy until he came because God is going to judge Christians as well as non-Christians. And so when Jesus does return, when the Battle of Armageddon does happen, they need to show themselves as doing God's work, and part of what they see as God's work is protecting Israel.
Well, Israel does a pretty good job of protecting itself. I don't know, have any of these people noticed that Israel is, well, I think, the fourth or fifth largest nuclear power on the planet, probably one of the most powerful armies on the planet, and they could wipe Iran off the map, not the other way around, you know.
Right, no, and that's certainly something they overlooked. They also overlooked the power of the Israeli state and the way the state intervenes in everyday citizens' lives in ways that Republicans would never stomach over here. There's, it's kind of selective support of Israel, and it's the same thing with the Pope. I mean, they like some of the things the Pope says, but they just ignore the things they don't like. It's the same with Israel.
So your sense then is that this is not Mark Huckabee trying to get headlines in this crowded field to just get some attention, because he's not up there. You know, believe it or not, the leader of the pack is Donald Trump, followed by either Jeb Bush or Scott Walker. And I think Huckabee is down at the bottom, I think, with those that are sort of not getting the attention. I don't have a poll in front of me, but that's my understanding. But you feel that the guy's speaking from the heart, that he really believes in the end of times.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's just a long history of evangelicals who believe that. It's supported by polling data as well as by the realities of the books they buy, the preachers they turn to. So this is something that will work to Huckabee's advantage in terms of getting him attention, but I don't think it's a manipulative ploy for the purpose of getting attention. I think he really believes that the Iran deal is bad for Israel, and anything that's bad for Israel is not only bad for Israel, but bad for America. And so that's the logic that has guided him throughout his career and will guide many evangelical Republicans as well.
So in terms of Christian values, which is they're all running on, at least Santorum and Huckabee, how do Christian values translate in terms of poisonous, hateful rhetoric? You've got Tom Cotton describing President Obama, saying he acted like Pontius Pilate. He washed his hands and over the Iran deal. And also Ted Cruz said that Obama is the world's greatest sponsor of global terrorism. You've got Huckabee's remarks. You've got the guy from Florida, Marco Rubio, saying that Obama has no class. All of it's very personal and hateful.
Yeah.
And what's so Christian about that?
Well, I'm not defending their positions or defending their ideology, but the way they would defend it, the way they would explain it, would be to say that that's what Old Testament prophets did and that God has called them to have this kind of prophetic voice. That if you look at, the rhetoric of Isaiah or Jeremiah or even the rhetoric of Jesus, he spoke boldly and confronted people in power, and he was not nice, he was not kind, he wasn't soothing. And so that's a self-serving argument to justify kind of the poisonous politics of where we are today in modern American culture. But for them, they wouldn't see it that way. They would see it as actually part of their calling to be faithful Christians, which is to call out evil where they see it. And they're not pacifists. They have no problems with using very harsh, violent rhetoric.
And again, I'm speaking with Matthew Sutton, who is a professor of history at Washington State University and a research fellow at the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation. His first book, Amy Semple McPherson and the Resurrection of Christian America, won the Thomas J. Wilson Memorial Prize from Harvard University Press. And his latest book just out is American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. And we're talking about remarks from Mike Huckabee running for president that have gotten attention from the president himself in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, lashed out at Huckabee and said, if the remarks are ridiculous and also sad. And I don't know what's your sense of whether any of this can be called out in this political year? I mean, to some extent, we've seen our politics get into this kind of, into the gutter. I think Fox News has had a big part in polarizing the country. It used to be that Republicans and Democrats actually were friends and went on family outings together, etc., and played baseball. And, Teddy Kennedy, for example, Senator Kennedy was best friends with Orrin Hatch, the conservative Republican from Utah, but those days seem to be over. So is this just the way it's going to be, do you think?
I think it will be for a little while, and I'm hopeful that things will turn back around. But, those old days, the Kenny Kennedy days, there were benefits to those guys, but there was also, they were, you know, it was a good old boys club, and there was a lot of backroom deals and a lot of things that the American people weren't aware of and weren't involved in terms of the process. So I don't like the polarization that we have today, but at the same time, I'm not sure that the transparency that we get with Fox News and with MSNBC, there are some benefits to people being more informed, although ideally, you know, hopefully there's a middle ground and you know, better venues to get your news than either of those two. But certainly there is something to be said about people having the freedom to speak their mind and to vote their conscience. That gets back to your question about Huckabee, though, about whether or not they really believe this stuff or they're just posturing. And I think many of them are posturing. But in the case of Huckabee, I think he is sincere. He's somebody who's gone off the deep end. I mean, he, you know, compared to the Huckabee of 4 and 8 years ago, he's getting crazier and crazier, but I don't think it's disingenuous. I think he's just getting crazier.
Well, when you say that the public are sick of Washington and backroom deals, that's the very appeal that Senator Ted Cruz is trying to tap into. And he's playing catch-up to Donald Trump, who has really tapped into the alienation out there, particularly amongst Republican primary voters, that you know, the system is corrupt, they're all part of a club, they don't care about you, they only care about themselves, and the nation is going to hell in a handbasket. That seems to be Trump's message, if there's any coherence to what he says.
Yeah, I mean, it's I'm fascinated by the Trump phenomenon. I mean, I'm just kind of shocked and horrified at how well he's doing. But I think for the Democrats, they just need to bring back James Carville and say it's the economy, stupid. And I think that's going to be an easy win for the Democrats as long as the economy continues to do as well as it's doing. So all of this kind of crazy rhetoric that's coming out of Huckabee or Trump, ultimately, as the Republican leaders know, it's just going to destroy the party. I mean, they have got to moderate. They've got to find a way to be more inclusive. They've got to broaden their appeal. And what we're seeing happen is just the opposite of that. So I'm sure, you know, the smart, sensible Republicans must just be horrified. I mean, I can't imagine that they're pleased with how things are going. This is just not what they wanted to have happen this time around.
But how do you explain this odd disconnect in the country, particularly with the religious right and that constituency, which I guess is the old Dixiecrat constituency that the Republicans picked up, and now it's pretty much the Republicans have pretty much become a white Southern party. But in terms of the old, you know, traditional Wall Street wing of the party, the Chamber of Commerce types, you were saying that maybe they're going to eventually prevail and get rid of Trump and get back to serious stuff. But nobody seems to point out the incredible irony of all this Obama hating. The wealthy in this country have never had it better than they've had it under Obama. Literally, they were on their knees after the 2008 crash. They'd blown the whole economy and put the global financial system, taken it to the cliff and in a near-death experience. Obama's brought it back. The banks are bigger than ever. The wealthy are wealthier than ever. The division between the rich and the poor has grown to the greatest proportions. And yet they vilify this man and call him a socialist. Go figure.
Yeah, no, and that's where I think the power of talk radio and Fox News comes in, and you see its negative effects. When I teach the Clinton years to my students, I talk about the rise of, you know, Rush Limbaugh and how he vilified Clinton as such a, you know, a liberal, a socialist. But when you look at Clinton's record, it was very moderate. It was, you know, very middle of the road. And in many ways, he took on a lot of agendas that the Republicans supported. And yet, the way that people understand these things has been so poorly framed by these quick sound bites in, you know, kind of cheap media. And so I think it's the same thing with Obama. I think if people dispassionately stood back and looked at their record, I think Republicans, especially moderate Republicans, would be quite pleased. But they just can't get over the fact that he's an African-American and he's doing well. And so they see what they want to see, which unfortunately is not often the reality. And that also, I think, explains the success of Bernie Sanders and why Bernie Sanders is appealing to a lot of liberal Democrats, because they recognize that more needs to be done to deal with the kinds of economic issues that you talked about than we see from Obama and then we'll probably see from Hillary Clinton.
But back to the theology, if that's not too generous a description, behind this end of times religious dogma that the Christian Zionists and Mike Huckabee and others and Santorum appeal to, although Santorum is a Catholic, I think he's still into that kind of stuff. What I don't understand is why, you know, there's no such thing as a religious left. If there is, they're certainly not anywhere near as vocal as a religious right. And anybody that has any cursory understanding of Christianity and its theology could point out that this stuff is obscene. It's spiritual pornography. The idea that our lives, you and my lives, have to end in burning flesh in order for their lives to begin, and the entire state of Israel gets incinerated except for 144,000 Jews who are converted on the spot. I mean, it's kind of spiritual pornography.
Well, yeah. I mean, I see why you see it that way. I see it that way. But the way they read the book of Revelation, the way they read, you know, Jesus' prophetic sermon in Matthew 24 about the end of times when there were going to be wars and rumors of wars and great earthquakes and environmental catastrophes, I mean, this is the way they read the Bible. Now, there are different ways to read those particular chapters and books. But for the last 150 years, and this is what I lay out in my American Apocalypse book, this theology has grown and grown and grown, because it has seemed to be confirmed first by World War One, and then by the Great Depression, and then World War Two, and then the Cold War, and then 9/11, and then now with global warming and the environmental crisis. I mean, just in the last 150 years, we've seen horrible cataclysms on this earth. And so for them, that's just confirmation of everything they predicted, of everything they expected. And so people like Billy Graham have made an entire career out of preaching hell and damnation and the end of times. And so they've, you know, written these runaway bestsellers, books like Hal Lindsey's Late Great Planet Earth in the 1970s, and more recently Tim LaHaye's series Left Behind in the films. I mean, people just eat this stuff up because it provides an answer to what troubles them. They look around the world, they see chaos, they see turmoil, they see problems. They don't know how to reconcile those things with their own lives, and so this apocalyptic theology gives them a way to do it. And it guarantees them that they're going to win in the end, that they're the ones who are going to come out and be victorious, that the world is getting worse, but that they're going to win. And so it's really comforting theology in that way for the people who are on the inside of it.
Well, but it's not very comforting for the rest of humanity, because if you believe that the world is going to end, then you're not worried about global warming or the environment. I mean, it's there to be raped and pillaged.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's why they've never embraced the environmental movement. At least, you know, and it's beginning to change. Some evangelicals are questioning this theology. It's been changing in the last 20 or 30 years, but in general, that's exactly right. That's why evangelicals have not been interested in the environmental movement. That's why they haven't supported it. That's why they've been reluctant to support a strong federal government or a strong United Nations, because they think all of these things are going to lead to Christians losing their rights and ultimately seceding them to the Antichrist in those last days.
So I guess to end on a slightly positive note, the Anti-Defamation League, which monitors anti-Semitism, denounced Huckabee's language. Its national director said, "To hear Mr. Huckabee invoke the Holocaust when America is Israel's greatest ally and when Israel is a strong nation capable of defending itself is disheartening." Needless to say, Huckabee himself has not backed down and has gone on the attack against Obama, who basically said it'd be ridiculous if it wasn't so sad. He sort of turned those words back at Obama. But the general tone is that Obama is naive and doesn't know what he's doing. And the other guy from Florida, Rubio, said he's got no class. I mean, there's something about the attitude and the tone that the Republicans have. Again, they constantly go after this president's basic legitimacy as a human being and as an American. And
yeah, and that I don't think is as much a reflection of their theology or their religion as where Republican politics is today. And that probably is them trying to stand out in a crowded field. But it's the way they do it, by talking about Israel and ovens and the Holocaust and appealing to people's emotions, that's where the theology comes in.
Well, Matthew Sutton, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ian. It was fun.
And again, I've been speaking with Matthew Sutton, who's a professor of history at Washington State University and a research fellow at the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation. His first book, Amy Semple McPherson and the Resurrection of Christian America, won the Thomas J. Wilson Memorial Prize from Harvard University Press. And his latest book just out is American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the possible release of an American inspired for Israel, Jonathan Pollard. In the light of a golden calf, oh God, the poison of your rage, don't think it fits when you turn the page. It was wrong, but you said it was right. In the future, I will read at night. And Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Melvin Goodman, who is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year career in government included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. He's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melvin Goodman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you again.
And Mel, it looks as though Jonathan Pollard, the American who spied for Israel, who has been in prison for 30 years now, he will be up for parole and apparently probably released on November the 21st, if all goes according to plan. But he has been used as a bargaining chip in negotiations with Israel, and a lot of Israeli leaders have gone out of their way to point out how valuable he is to Israel. And now, of course, there's this idea that in order to get Israel off Obama's back over the Iran deal, they'll let Pollard out. So what's your sense of why this fellow is so important to Israel?
Well, I don't know if he's important to Israel in a real geopolitical sense or national security sense. They did run him as a spy, as an agent. They denied that at the beginning. They called it a maverick operation. I think Israel is trying to get every advantage it can get after losing on the Iranian nuclear agreement. I think they're wrong about the Iranian nuclear agreement, and we're right about Jonathan Pollard. And I think there are things that the American public doesn't really understand about Pollard, because if you read the press coverage, particularly in the New York Times and the Washington Post, you get the feeling that Pollard was a Zionist who came out of a Zionist background who was trying to help Israel. There are things that should be known about Pollard. One, he tried to sell this information to other countries, including Libya and Saudi Arabia, before he ever contracted with Israel. And I think that's significant. That doesn't suggest that he's a Zionist. Two, some of the materials that ended up in the hands of Israeli intelligence officials ended up in Moscow. So you know there were some leaks in the intelligence system in Israel, and Pollard is responsible for allowing that information, very sensitive information, by the way, to get to the Soviet Union. And finally, he gave up extremely sensitive security information dealing with communications links and signals links that made it more difficult for the United States to monitor certain Palestinian terrorists groups. And there were at least several operations that probably, that were certainly conducted by terrorists against Israel that probably could have been prevented if those sites had not been compromised. So lives were lost in Israel because of the work that Pollard did. So the Israelis have lied about Pollard from the very beginning, and they've been hypocrites all along. And I remember in the 1990s when there was tremendous pressure on Bill Clinton, who was about to bow to that pressure in discussions over an Israeli-Palestinian agreement. It was the CIA director, George Tenet, and I'm no fan of George Tenet, but he told President Clinton, if you release Pollard, I'm resigning as director of the CIA. So these were extremely sensitive pieces of information that thoroughly compromised the work of the National Security Agency, very legitimate work, in the Middle East. And a lot of information was lost because of what Pollard did. So I have no sympathy for Pollard whatsoever. If the deal was that 30 years he was a good citizen, he could be released, so be it. But it should not have nothing to do with the Iranian nuclear agreement. The only mystery to me in all of this, and I've never been able to resolve this one, is that there was a secret letter that Secretary of Defense Weinberger sent at the last minute to the judge that had something to do with the heavy sentence that Pollard got. But I always thought that strong sentence had a lot to do with the sensitivity of what he compromised. He gave away everything that we had in the Middle East in terms of collection, in terms of sensitive signals and communications intelligence. So he was spying. He was spying for money. He was not a Zionist, and he was selling to the highest bidder.
Well, my understanding is he also worked for the National Reconnaissance Office, which is where all the satellite overheads are downloaded. It's the most sensitive and most secret part of U.S. intelligence, or at least among the most secret part of U.S. intelligence, and that by having this material go to Israel and then end up in Russia, or the Soviet Union as it was then, The thing that is really damaging is that if the countries that you're targeting with overheads know about the capability of your satellites, then they can use measures to disguise what you're looking for. And he gave them information that allowed the Soviets to cover up a lot of their activities, which they had normally not covered up because they weren't aware that the US had the capabilities to monitor them from above. That's also, you know, happened with the KH-11 that was compromised by the Boyce, the Falcon and the Snowman spies, etc. So isn't that a factor? That it's really the worst damage you can do to US intelligence is to tell whoever you're targeting what the capabilities are of...
Oh, there's no question of that. And you could say that the National Reconnaissance Office is extremely sensitive in terms of intelligence. But I would argue the National Security Agency, in terms of indicators for war, indicators for terrorism, indicators for violence, provide more sensitive intelligence than any other agency in Washington. So when you add the two of them together, the NSA and the NRO, and his access in both of these organizations, but particularly in the National Security Agency, that's where the most specific damage was done, including damage to Israel itself. This is what I find so incredible about so-called Israeli sympathy for Jonathan Pollard. They're out there to grab as much as they can to make up for their defeat over Iran. And the sad thing is, we've always caved into the Israelis on this level. Whenever there's been an agreement, they've extracted a price for it, whether it was aircraft sales to Saudi Arabia or whatever the United States was trying to do in the Middle East. And I wish the United States would come to the realization that Netanyahu is no friend of the United States. He's no ally of the United States. He's a total hypocrite. He's totally intransigent about things that are important to us, and we have to pursue our own interest. And in the case of the Iranian nuclear accord, it is in our interest. And Israeli concerns, I think, should have to be placed on a back burner. Now, with the domestic political situation being what it is, and Senator Chuck Schumer is a major force in this regard, there are some hurdles that we're going to have to jump. But in the final analysis, we should go ahead with the Iranian nuclear accord, and we shouldn't give in to Israel on arms or Jonathan Pollard or any other quid pro quo that they're going to demand.
So the Israelis, he did, as you mentioned, he tried to sell these secrets first to the Saudi Arabians and to Libya, and then he settled on the Israelis, who paid him $1,500 a month. They bought his wife diamonds and sapphires, and they sent the couple on expensive European vacations. And it's sort of interesting that his wife, Anne Pollard, is one of the main advocates for his release, even though it seems as though she could have been charged as well and wasn't. Do you think the American Jewish community that supports Israel, are they aware of the damage this guy did to this country? Because, you know,
well, I do a lot of lecturing here for Johns Hopkins University, and I travel around the country. And, of course, there's tremendous Jewish sensitivity on this issue. I'm Jewish, for that matter, so I understand some of their sensitivity. But, frankly, when I've told them who Jonathan Pollard is and what he represents and how the Israelis have lied about all of this, they tend to back off and quite understand what's at stake here. So, for the most part, I think it's their ignorance about Jonathan Pollard. There is a gut reflex here, a gut reaction, that there's this Jew in jail who was trying to help Israel, as if Israel didn't get tremendous amounts of intelligence from the United States and also from the CIA, including satellite photography. You know, remember going back to the 1980s when the Israelis bombed the reactor, the Osirak reactor in Iraq. They did so with intelligence that was provided by William Casey's CIA. And this has been true for a lot of sensitive Israeli missions. So for them to go beyond what they were getting through traditional channels to recruit this guy and then exploit this guy, I think was just outrageous. And we should make that clear to the Israelis right along, including when he's probably released in November, that this was unacceptable behavior on their part. But we know from Netanyahu coming to the United States and interfering in American domestic politics and interfering in American foreign policy for that matter, that there's no limit to the attempts they won't make to put pressure on this government. And they use every resource they have, including senators like Chuck Schumer. I worry about Ben Cardin from Maryland in this regard, who's very close to the Jewish community in Maryland. But it's something that's an American national interest, and we should pursue our national interests, and Israeli interests are just secondary as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Ann Pollard, Pollard's ex-wife, on Israeli television said that the Israeli government should fund a budget so that Jonathan can hire a top-notch attorney for his upcoming parole hearing, and once he's released, he will want to move to Israel 100%, she said. Otherwise, nothing would make sense to him. That's a little odd, isn't it? Because when he was actually caught by the FBI, he was trying to break into the Israeli embassy to get refuge, and they shut him out. So they hung him out to dry, and as you mentioned, initially they denied that he was a spy for them.
Well, they totally dissociated him. Themselves from him in the beginning, but then it became so obvious and we had so much evidence and Pollard himself started talking that their denials were, of course, meaningless. But I would assume he would leave this country as soon as he could. I don't know what the terms of the release would be, but good riddance to bad rubbish, I've heard someone say.
Well, but the idea that you can have dual citizenship with America and Israel, and somehow you know that Netanyahu's been trying to get French Jews to go to Israel, and the idea that this is the ultimate home and haven for anybody who feels that they need refuge, I can see how that resonates and why it's important to people around the world of the Jewish faith. But
it's never resonated in the United States. In fact, the first Israeli prime minister to realize that was Ben-Gurion, and he was shocked. There were a lot of Israelis in the very early period after independence in 1948 who genuinely believed that American Jews would be leaving the United States to make aliyah to Israel, and they were shocked. But that's something the Israelis understand, that Israel is a Middle Eastern country. And for American Jews, and most American Jews who travel there, understand that Israel is a part of the Middle East, and their political structure, their political institutions are far different from ours, and their political culture is far different from ours. So there's, of course, a lot of emotion tied up with Israel, a lot of it to do with a certain amount of guilt stemming from the Holocaust. But it's not going to lead American Jews to make aliyah to Israel any more than French Jews were about to leave. And I thought Netanyahu went too far when he tried to recruit Jewish emigration from France. But Netanyahu is essentially out of control, and I think we've learned that over the last few years. Even Israeli security officials, and I've talked to a few from my CIA connections with the Mossad, understand that the Iranian nuclear agreement is not a bad deal for Israel. In fact, in some ways, it makes a lot of sense. It is Netanyahu, for political reasons, who I think is not worried so much about nuclear weapons, but worried about a new American relationship with a major state in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf that could alter the arrangement that the United States has, in which we solely identify with Israel. This is what Netanyahu is trying to foreclose. And I think Israeli security officials understand that.
Well, you know, when you say Netanyahu's out of control, I mean, some of these Republicans running for president are out of control. You know, obviously, Donald Trump is obviously out of control, but he has a peculiar agenda. But Huckabee, you know, maybe Huckabee's trying, because there's like 16 of them, he's trying to break out and get some attention by making this outrageous charge that Obama is marching the Israelis to the doors of the gas ovens because of his deal with Iran. That, by the way, was supported by Rick Santorum. Jeb Bush repudiated and said it wasn't a particularly helpful remark. But, you know, it gets to the sort of heart of this appeal that Christian Zionists have to Israel being the trigger to create Armageddon and to bring about an end to the world. I mean, that's kind of spiritual pornography. and, you know, so irresponsible that you want.
Oh, it's totally irresponsible. But then when you look at the Israeli side of the equation, look at the scurrilous remarks being made about President Obama. That's incredibly ugly. And it's Israel is going to have to discipline itself at some point. You know, the general mood internationally is incredibly hostile to Israel. When you look at what happened in Gaza and the war crimes that were committed last summer that have not been fully investigated as far as I'm concerned, and what Israel has done has isolated itself. It's created itself as a pariah state in this near-term situation. And for them to then antagonize the only ally they have in the world, which is the United States, seems outrageous to me. And a lot of Israeli public officials know that, and they've addressed that, and they've commented on it. But that's where I refer to Netanyahu, who's being out of control. Certainly coming here, taking that ridiculous invitation from Representative Boehner, which he should have ignored or turned down or somehow gracefully handled, but it made no sense for him to come here whatsoever. He overplayed his hand terribly.
Well, just in closing, Mel Goodman, I don't know whether he's a colleague of yours, but Paul Pillar, the former National Intelligence Officer for the Middle East at the CIA, wrote a piece recently where, based upon remarks from senior Israeli officials, he was concerned that in the summer, Israel may strike Hezbollah that's overextended in Syria, and then Hezbollah would rain rockets down on Israel, and that the optics of that would be such that it would change the entire debate in the Congress, and they'd be able to peel off enough people like Ben Cardin and others that you mentioned so that they could override Obama's expected veto of an expected rejection of this P5 plus one deal with Iran by the Congress, the Republican Congress, I might add. So, you know, the fact that it was extended to 60 days, There's reason to take that kind of possibility seriously if, as you say, Netanyahu is out of control.
Well, I don't think the Israelis want a wider confrontation over Syria. They know the forces involved in Syria, both the internal forces and external forces, are totally preoccupied, and they like it that way. The only time Israel interferes is when they see Iran supplying military supplies to Hezbollah that are being delivered into Syria, and then we have seen some use of very modest, very specifically targeted Israeli attacks. Now, I don't expect them to do the kind of thing that would lead Hezbollah to use its missiles and its rockets that have been supplied by Iran that would allow Israel to have a full engagement against Lebanon. That I don't expect to see. The Syrian situation is changing greatly, and particularly with the deals that are being talked about and concluded between the United States and Turkey to create some kind of safe zone along the border with Syria and Turkey, and for Assad to recognize that he's got serious problems now, including manpower problems. I think Israel is just going to let that play out on its own because it's working to their advantage anyway.
Well, it's true that Israel's perfectly happy to see its enemies kill each other. So you don't buy Paul Pillar's speculation?
No, I know Paul very well, and I agree with a lot of his writing, but I think that one is kind of worst-casing the situation to a great degree. Frankly, I don't think there's going to be so much Democratic failure to support this deal that would allow a veto to be overridden in any fashion. I think the Democrats are going to be there in the final analysis. I've talked to a couple people on the Hill. I've called a couple congressional offices. In fact, I've called Cardin's office. And I think at the end of the day, even Cardin's going to support this agreement. And I know some of the key representatives will also. So I think we will probably have a veto at the end of the day, and that veto will be sustained.
Well, I think that any American politician, Democrat or Republican, should support this deal on the very principle of the separation of powers. And if you don't support this deal, you're going against the Constitution, against the idea that the executive branch can go out and negotiate deals around the world. You know, we'll end up with 535 secretaries of state if they can override this veto.
Well, there's so many aspects of this deal that are important. The international diplomacy, as Secretary of State Kerry played it, putting together a multilateral coalition to negotiate this agreement, the fact that the sanctions structure has already been structured in a way that it's going to break down, and these congressional sanctions will count for nothing, so it would be totally feckless on their part. And the damage that they would do to an American president and the prestige of the United States would be overwhelming. So, it to me, on political grounds, on military grounds, and as you say, on constitutional grounds in terms of separation of powers, it really would not make any sense whatsoever. But they're going to have their day. They're going to have a chance to conduct this harangue. But the deal is a good one. And the verification, I worked on SALT, and I was involved in SALT negotiations in the early 1970s. I have never seen the verification system as intrusive and as thorough and as complex as this one. So even the experts who were leery about the agreement are starting to come around, and I find that extremely impressive. And the Secretary of Energy, I think, has been very impressive
sure.
to try to explain the agreement to a public that really knows very little about it, and congressional representatives who are talking about something they've never bothered to read or to educate themselves on.
Mm. Well, Mal Goodman, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you. Ian, good to be with you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. He's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the talks underway in Ethiopia between President Obama and African leaders over the future of South Sudan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lako Tongan, who's a professor of international and intercultural studies and political studies at Pfizer College. He was born and raised in what is the world's newest country, South Sudan, now undergoing a murderous power struggle between its leaders. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lako Tongan.
Thank you, Ian, for this opportunity to participate in the Background Briefing.
Well, Lako, I know you've just come back from a trip to Africa. You were just in Nairobi, where the president was, and now the president, Obama, is in Ethiopia, where he has convened a summit meeting with Ethiopia's leader, along with the leaders of Kenya, Sudan, and the African Union, to try and figure out what they can do about South Sudan. And I remember talking to you when you were in South Sudan, when the country was born, and all of the hopes that the country had, and it quickly descended into a fratricidal civil war, largely as a result of a power struggle between the president and the vice president. Is that as simple as it is?
That is a good summary of what is happening. And just to add a little bit to your introduction, I just came back last week, actually. I was in Rwanda, Uganda, Kenya, and South Sudan was the last country to visit. And suddenly, the country is in bad shape. I've been going for the anniversaries three times now. This was my third time. And so, absolutely, the party struggle in the country has destroyed, I would say, in fact, the country, both economically and politically, physically also, because the economy literally has collapsed. There is no way of sustaining, you know, the lives of the population. And so I just came back, you know, really saddened by what is happening in the country. And you are absolutely right that when I was there in 2011, July, that is the independence of this young country, there was a great optimism, great hope, you know, and aspirations of South Sudanese, you know, about the future. But now all that has been dashed. And in fact, I would say South Sudanese do not have time even to absorb the meaning of being independent since this conflict just broke out just 3 years after the independence.
Well, so far, this conflict has cost tens of thousands of lives, and there are 2.2 million South Sudanese who have been displaced. What was the population when independence was declared recently?
The estimates of the populations, I mean, of the number of people in South Sudan has been varying in terms of the estimates, depending who is giving the estimates. The World Bank estimated that there were 12 million people at the time of independence. But Sudan, namely the government of Sudan, estimated that it was 8 million people. But since then, no census have been taken, you know, really to determine the number of population, as in many African countries, it's always difficult to determine the correct number of the population.
But since you were there recently, Largo, what was the sense amongst the people? They must be traumatized if 2.2 million have been displaced and hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands have been murdered in a very brutal civil war.
Absolutely. Perhaps one has to clarify where this conflict, actually the fighting, is taking place. It is not in the whole region, as you know, South Sudan as a whole. Much of the killings is occurring in the northern part of the country, where the two ethnic groups that are at war actually are fighting, namely the Nuer and the Dinkas. In other parts, the suffering is more a result of the collapse of the economy. And so the threat, for example, of famine is broadly, you know, spread actually all over the country in terms of that possibility of famine. In Juba, the capital where I'm from, there is certainly anger. People are very, very angry. People are, of course, saddened by the fact that the economy has collapsed. For example, in Juba, the capital, it is difficult to get clean water. And just as I was there, we have cholera attacks that are still that is still going on, even as we are speaking now. And so the whole infrastructure of providing for the population has actually collapsed. And as I think foreign observers have made, you know, very clearly, the leadership seems to be unconcerned about the sufferings of the people. And this is, of course, in addition to the fact that South Sudan won this independence, you know, very dearly in terms of the casualties and also the length of the fighting, 50 years of armed struggle at the cost of 3 million lives. So in a sense, there is dismay, actually, among the Southern Sudanese how the leadership has failed them by engaging in this power struggle.
And again, I'm speaking with Lako Tongan, who's a professor of international intercultural studies and political studies at Fraser College. He was born and raised in what is the world's newest country, South Sudan, now undergoing a murderous power struggle between its leaders. And the leaders are, of course, President Salva Kiir and the Vice President, Riek Machar, who commands the rebels. And the rebels, of course, are the newer pitted against Kiir's powerful Dinka tribe. And that seems to be the impression that these people just don't give a damn about their own citizens who are dying in droves, because these two just have butting heads and have a power struggle. And it really gets to the heart, Lako, of what President Obama had promised in terms of his policies towards Africa, that he would support strong institutions and not strong men. If ever there was an example of the worst of strong men, it's these two characters.
Yes, and I think this is characteristic, I would say, actually, of Africa as a whole, in terms of what is sometimes referred to as the big man syndrome, you know, in Africa, namely that Salva Kiir, who comes, of course, from the Dinka ethnic group, don't want to really give up power, and even, you know, through the electoral process. Which was supposed to be the case. You know, this year was scheduled to be the presidential elections for this young country. And so the power struggle that started in December was his attempt, actually, to subvert the process of this, you know, pending elections that were supposed to take place this year. And so... and here, ethnicity also intrudes in, because each of the two leaders have their ethnic support, and each ethnic group has certain claims that they are entitled to rule South Sudan. And that is what is making it very difficult, really complex, in terms of how to resolve this problem. That is the internal dimension of this conflict. But there are also external factors that intrudes in. For example, Uganda has intervened militarily, and there are Uganda troops fighting on the side of the government. In addition to that, also Sudan, of course, which is the you know, the country from which South Sudan broke from, has a lot of interest also in this conflict. In fact, there is no doubt that it has sympathy for Riek Machar, namely the opposition. And just to give you a sense, I had an opportunity to meet the leadership of the opposition in Nairobi, and what I get from them is that really this ethnic factor is going to be key in resolving or ending this conflict in South Sudan, if they can be forced, you know, to abandon these ethnic claims to be, you know, leader or to head the leadership of the country.
So what do you think the meeting in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, with President Obama and the leaders from Kenya, Ethiopia, Uganda, Sudan, and the African Union, apparently they're saying that the South Sudanese warring factions have to reach a peace deal by August the 17th. But what leverage do they have over these people who, as you point out, they don't seem to care about anybody, or at least of all their own people? It's a power struggle. And
That is a good question, and the complexity, I think, of what these external factors are trying to do, namely how to resolve the conflict, is that they also seem to fail to take into account the other, what I might call the silent majority within South Sudan, you know, who are not being factored into this negotiation. For example, what is generally South Sudan is divided into three regions, and these regions were established during the British colonial rule. So you got Upper Nile, you got Baragazel, and you got Equatoria. Now, the conflict tend to be more concentrated in Upper Nile, where you got most of the Dinkas and the Nuers located. But then you have Bragazan, where it is mixed, and then you got Equatoria, where there are no Dinkas nor Nuer, again, in terms of traditionally, who are the people who inhabited those areas. And so these negotiations are not taking into account these other groups. Okay? And so the solutions that they are trying to, I think, bring to South Sudan is that it is going to be just resolving the conflict between the two major ethnic groups. They are major ethnic groups. They are not majority. Mm-hmm. The Dinkas are estimated to be about 25%. The Nuers are about 15%. So if you add these two, you know, it makes something like 40%, and you got 60% of the population that is not, you know, integrated into this idea of resolving the conflict. So I'm afraid that even though they might, which I doubt, that they might be able to bring the two together, there are profound issues that have to be solved as to how the government is constituted, you know, the structural reforms that are to be carried out within the government, and particularly within the military. The military currently is no longer national. The military, in fact, has descended into ethnic military groups and so forth, militias, actually.
Well, but the fighting itself, you said, is in the north, and that's where the oil is. So oil must be a big factor in this.
Absolutely. Oil is a big factor, and interestingly enough, the oil is located in the Nuer area. And so the Nuers, in a sense, can stop, actually, the flow of the oil. And that also brings in, actually, the role of the Sudan and the Chinese, because the Chinese are more interested in protecting their oil interests, or the interests in the oil in South Sudan, and also the same with Sudan. And so, in fact, China is playing a double game in this conflict, even though it is going to be one of the participants, you know, in bringing about supposedly an end to this war. And that double game involves, first of all, supporting the regime in Juba by providing arms and also loans. But at the same time, also, it has sympathy working with Khartoum, and Khartoum has sympathy with the rebels, who can control the oil fields, particularly with support of Khartoum. So the internal as well as the external factors are complicating how Obama administration might try to resolve this conflict. And I'm afraid that it might not be easy, actually, for them.
Well, Lakka Tongan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I appreciate this, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Lakka Tongan, who's a professor of international intercultural studies and political studies at Pfizer College. He was born and raised in what is the world's newest country, South Sudan, now undergoing a murderous power struggle between its leaders. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.